Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today is Daniel McAdams, our co-host. Daniel, good to see you.
Good morning, Dr. Paul. How are you?
Welcome to a new week.
A new week, yes.
And I was going to say we are going to have a new topic, but no, we're just going to refresh an old topic that's been around. I wish there were a truly new topic where where peace was breaking out in the world. But, you know, the fact that we're going to be talking about foreign policy today, because it's in the news, you know, sounds like Biden's a tough guy. He's not going to get pushed around. And certainly they're not going to get away with pushing around in Iraq and these sort of things. But the fact that there might be a little bit less news about the battle against the virus, against coronavirus, might mean that maybe that battle is sort of settling down. Maybe they're going to admit that, you know, the crisis has passed. 99.9% of the people not getting sick. So I guess the lockdown really helped. And I'm being facetious, of course, because there's still a lot of activity. There's still a lot of lockdown problems. But the people are waking up. I think the numbers of people growing now to realize this might not be necessary.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about foreign policy, and maybe it's because there's less a problem with the other. But that'll last for a while, too, because there's still a steady attack on our civil liberties and our privacy. And that can occur when you have a domestic problem, such as an endemic or a crisis of some magnitude like 9/11. It's always an attack on liberty, and certainly during wartime it's an attack on liberty. Some of the most abuses that we have put up with throughout our history, especially back all the way back to the Civil War. That's when people were scared. You got to be patriotic. You got to obey the state. And although we've complained a lot about what's happened with coronavirus, during wartime in our past history, 100 years or so, some very, very serious attacks on personal liberty. But that's continuing. It's a lot of us fear it more because the technology is getting so much better in snooping. And that, of course, is a concern with the coronavirus because of the passports and these kind of things that are coming. But anyway, there's a lot of talk, and we want to talk most specifically more about Syria and who's involved. We're going to sort it out and tell our audience just which political party's the most guilty. So we'll do that. But this involves, when we talked about doing this, I said we need to talk about Syria. There's always activity there. But then when I looked at it, you can't talk about Syria or Syria and the U.S. The Republicans or the Democrats. You have Republican Democrats, you have the deep state, you have the military industrial complex, you have the Russians, you have U.S. coups. Yeah. I can't believe that we participate in these coups and we maintain them. And then there are a couple other countries significant in this. Israel is a significant player. Iraq, Iran, Ukraine, and Russians dealing with Crimea, that's important. But you know, the one country I didn't mention, because hopefully is being diminished, might be that much of a success, Afghanistan. Is it finally going to go away? I'm not predicting that, but at least it's a little more settled than what's going on in Syria. But if I think about, what has been the immediate problem? Immediate in the last 4, 5, 6 years or a couple of administrations. Of course, it's been the Obama administration, the fighting the good war and pursuing on that, but also the coup in the Ukraine and Syria and all of these places and the stuff he did in Libya. And he hasn't fulfilled the image that has been put on him, and probably still exists, that he's the peace candidate. He got the Nobel Peace Prize, so he must be a peaceful person. But even Trump, with his shortcomings, has to be given a couple points for not being as bad as Biden. And yet Trump certainly, even dealing with Iran, it's nothing to brag about from a constitutional libertarian viewpoint.
Yeah, that's true. And the reason we're bringing it up, of course, is on Thursday, one of President Obama's first foreign policy actions was to, again, start launching missiles into Syria. And it did. The administration did it in a corner of Syria that borders with Iraq. And what was happening there is that the Syrian military was cooperating with Iraqi popular mobilization forces. And these are militias that were formed in 2014 when ISIS was overrunning Iraq, and it was extremely dangerous. So they formed these militias to explicitly for fighting ISIS in Iraq, and they made a lot of headway in getting ISIS out of Iraq. Well, this group was acting with the Syrian military on the border to prevent ISIS from going back and forth. And for some reason, the Biden administration decided to throw a few bombs their way. What they did is they blamed them for some rocket attacks on the U.S. embassy in Iraq and in other U.S. facilities. They blamed this group. The group said, "We didn't do it. Why would we do that? We're busy fighting ISIS. You should be too." So they attacked them on Thursday. Apparently, at least 22 people were killed. I think 17 of them were members of this Iraqi militia group. But it raises some huge questions about the Biden foreign policy. And, you know, we both read Scott Ritter's great piece on it, basically saying it's an incomprehensible foreign policy, because how is it that you're attacking and fighting the people who were fighting ISIS at the same time saying that we're there to fight ISIS? You know, it makes no sense. And we can get into some of these things later, right, about it.
And you mentioned the Biden foreign policy, and that's what we're talking about, and it certainly does exist. But in some ways, it is part of another policy. It's part of the overall policy of what the U.S. policy has been and probably will continue to be, and that is the assumption that we own these countries. If we commit and participate in a coup or we get into a battle, then we end up saying that we have a right to do it. There was one article out that the people say that the excuse is, we have a right to do this. We're okay. And I just wonder, by what right? Is there a moral right that we need to do this bombing? Oh, it's defense. You know, we'll do this and it'll claim it's national defense. But both political parties did this. So you go in, you send your troops in there into a place we shouldn't be in. And as a matter of fact, that subject came up when they were arguing the authority to go into the Iraq war. And that is, well, they were shooting at our airplanes.
Yeah.
You know, of course, we were over there bombing them. And that's why we had to go to war, because those people who were getting the bombs dropped on them. So it's always the bombs. But when you look at this, we spend a lot of money. This is another excuse to continue to spend the money. It looks like Raytheon might work out. They might be voted to stay into the deep state. They have a little influence, a little money going on. So they're very much involved. But they're not Republicans or Democrats. They're deep state people, and nobody can say anything. Where's been the real resistance when Trump got some subtle acceptances when he'd do something tough like dropping bombs or murdering somebody? You know, they didn't complain about that, but they look around for other things. But the antagonism and the conflict has to keep it going. We spend more money than anybody else, and yet we have to spend more and more. So there's always this warmongering going on, always this preparation. And right now, since this has been not quite as active and this is sort of stirring it up, it worries me, because what do they have planned? But I'll bet you the strongest motivation is probably selling weapons.
Yeah, I
don't think they... Well, there's hope. There's hope they didn't decide that they just want to see more chaos and more killing. But when you participate in a coup in various countries, all the way back to Vietnam, you have to say that, yeah, they may pretend or they may argue that we're doing this for humanitarian reasons, but it's always with the knowledge that a lot of people are going to die, and they have a blank eye to that.
Yeah, they do. And, you know, the one thing that's interesting about this, and of course it was pointed out right away, is the politicization of the U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. And this is now the spokesperson for the White House, the press secretary for President Biden. And here she was back in April of 2017 when it was Trump dropping the bombs. Just look at this first clip. And what is the legal authority for the strikes? Assad is a brutal dictator, but Syria is a sovereign country. That didn't age well. And let's go straight to the top. Look at the next one. Here's what Biden said around the same time. When Trump was bombing Syria, he said Trump's erratic, impulsive actions are the last thing we need as commander-in-chief. No president shall order a military strike without fully understanding the consequences. We don't need another war in the Middle East. But Trump's actions toward Iran only make that more likely. And Scott Ritter said this in his piece. Literally, these two tweets could go out today saying the same thing, but just change Biden for Trump, because essentially that's what it was doing. What was the legal authority? You're going to like this, Dr. Paul. The legal authority cited by the administration was the 2002 authorization for the use of military force against Iraq to take out Saddam Hussein. They still keep dusting that thing off and shining it up and putting it together. But, you know, our good friend Thomas Massie made some very good points when this first happened. And I don't have the, unfortunately, don't have the tweet up. I didn't send it out. But what he pointed out was the role of Congress. He said back when Trump launched the attack against General Soleimani in Iraq, remember this, in January last year, the Democrats offered a resolution to assert that any further attacks against Iran would require the proper approval of Congress. I was only one of three Republicans to vote for that. So basically he's saying, last time Trump did this kind of thing, the Democrats in Congress were up in arms. You're going to have to ask us if you want to do it again. And he's pointing out, so this is now the shoe's on the other foot. Are you guys going to say anything? Are you going to offer a resolution saying that the president's got to come to Congress and try to get a declaration before he does it? And probably not.
Probably not. That's pandering. That's not dealing in any particular issues or principles. But Biden was emphatic that there is a purpose for this, and that is to warn Iran.
Yeah.
We got to contain Iran. They're never going to get a nuclear weapon, and da da da. You know, his attitude is slightly different than Trump's, but it's no more conciliatory. I'll tell you that. They might talk more international, but that is high on the agenda. And guess when that all started? It was 1953. This has been going on, and it never stops. And they keep saying that we have to contain them because they're angry and violent people. And then they have to go and actually exaggerate on how dangerous they are. They're dangerous if we're in their face and dropping bombs on them. But at other times, they make some effort, which I believe on the surface, I think they really wanted to see that treaty work. And that they would back off a little bit. And some progress was made. But no, you cannot be friends with Iran, because then you also have Israel's position in this, and that can never be violated. And that won't change, you know, with Biden either. So it's going to be, these will be the players. But it's been going on for a long time. It's the principle, though. If you want to look, how do you bring all this together? It's the principle that we have a moral right for interventionism wherever we want. And because we have the money and the bombs, we do what we want, but someday that will come to an end.
Yeah, that's true. One of the really fascinating aspects of this whole chapter now is the role of the Iraqi government in this U.S. attack on Iraqi paramilitary forces. The question is, was Iraq involved, the Iraqi government involved, or was it not? Either way, this puts the Iraqi government in a terrible, terrible, untenable position. As you say, the U.S. really doesn't care much about its allies. The Iraqi government has said, we had no part in this. We did not participate at all in the airstrikes. We didn't have any role. Either way, whatever's true, whether they did it, whether they didn't, it looks terrible because, number one, if the Iraqi government actually was cooperating with the U.S. on this attack, it means the Iraqi government was collaborating with the U.S. to attack forces of the Iraqi government, because the militias that the U.S. attacked have been integrated into the Iraqi military structure. So it's essentially, if they were part of it, Iraq is attacking its own army, which is terrible and makes no sense. If, as Iraq says, they were kept in the dark and had no role in it, then that's at least as bad, if not worse, because that shows that even after the Iraqi parliament voted that the U.S. needs to get its military out of Iraq, that's a sovereign, democratically elected government. Even after that, even after all this, the U.S. just doesn't care, doesn't believe that Iraq has any sovereignty whatsoever, doesn't need to be consulted on something that's taking place against the Iraqi military itself. So either way, either Iraq is attacking its own military, or yet again, after 18 years, Iraq is simply still a U.S. puppet.
You know, as a problem that was really created by the Obama administration in the in Crimea and in the Ukraine, this was all constructed by individuals that have been around a long time. Our State Department and our ambassador there, you know, put this all together, and they picked and choose, and they were caught doing their planning. And now Biden is being very tough on this, and it might be for more grandstanding than anything else. But he said the U.S. and he and their administration will never accept the fact that Crimea is part of Russia. Of course, you can go back and forth on exactly how and when. But one thing that convinced me that it hasn't been done properly is that there has been some honest surveys of the people there, and most of them are Russian-speaking people that won it. Matter of fact, that was why the coup came, because through the electoral process, they were winning the elections. They were winning support for the country. So the U.S. and other allies, energy people and whatnot, were not going to be satisfied with that. But it's just this antagonism that, you know, doesn't ever go away. If they're not really into it, they can threaten people, and then the next step is we're going to bomb you, then we're going to put sanctions on you, and because they're all evil people. And then the situation is such that if you are willing to analyze our own policy, like Thomas Massie is,
yeah,
guess what? You can be criticized as being un-American, unpatriotic if you're criticizing the government. But that defies my understanding of what a patriot ought to be, somebody who is allowed to and willing to criticize their own government. Mm-hmm. That is what is necessary if you want to live in a free country.
Exactly. And, you know, you mentioned the Crimea situation, and I noticed also Biden's defense secretary said that basically the same thing. We will never recognize. Well, as you say, if you don't want this kind of stuff to happen, then don't start coups. You know, the U.S. fomented this coup. The U.S. brought about this coup that took out a popularly elected president and put in a group of people who viciously and virulently hate Russians and hate all things Russian. They're the ones that took away the right to speak the Russian language at first. And when this happened, as you say, the people of Crimea, who are by and large, I think 90% Russian-speaking, identify as Russians. So they had a vote. They voted on it. Hey, we don't want to be part of this country that hates us. I think we'll go ahead and join Russia. And that is what they hate. But looking at the Syria bombing again in a larger context, there's some really important things, I think, that go into this. And one of these things is, as you say, Israel and Iran, because we know definitely that Israel is desperate and they're pulling out all stops to prevent Biden from rejoining the JCPOA, the Iran deal, which is something consistently that Biden has promised to do. That was one of the legitimate things he was criticizing Trump for. Why did you get out of this deal? It's the stupidest thing ever. I'll take us back into it. So now that he's actually sitting in office, things are looking a little bit different from his view. Israel is putting out tons and tons of pressure, covert and overt, to prevent this from happening. This attack on the Iran-backed forces from Iraq and Syria, this is going to make it much harder for any kind of diplomacy with Iran, because it just shows, once again, the U.S. isn't an honest player. They're out there acting like ISIS's Air Force, attacking and killing these people that are fighting ISIS. What is the incentive to sit down at the table with this duplicitous administration, the same as the last duplicitous administration? So it really puts Biden in a terrible box and terrible bind. The only thing that's going to make his life easier is the fact that nobody in Washington wants to go back to the JCPOA anyway. So he's not going to take a lot of political heat for doing that. But the question is, among his constituency who views him as a grown-up back in the room who's going to pursue diplomacy, well, this is not looking a lot like diplomacy to me.
Of course, the so-called allies we have in Europe are all for staying out of it, too, you know, not going back. But this invites a discussion or an attempt at trying to understand it, because it really splits the deep state issue most of the time we think of, and there is a bit of unity in a deep state. They all have one, they might have different angles that are coming out, but here Israel, which is the staunch ally of everybody on this side of the ocean, then they have to fight with the deep state. So, or the people who are trying to come up with a decent policy.
Yeah. Well, you know, Biden has brought his own branch of the deep state back in, people like Tony Blinken, who've been around forever. He was one of the earliest, very, very strong proponents of the Iraq War back in 2003. He was solidly behind as administration, top administration official, the Libya debacle, which you pointed out, the Syria disaster, the Ukraine disaster. He is all for these interventions. He's all for regime change. He's all for overturning elections when he believes it suits U.S. foreign policy. And you talked about it earlier. We were talking about Jen Psaki before the room, before the show started. Well, where was she when she was saying this thing in 2017? Well, what they do is they get in the administration, then when their guys get out of power, they go hide in some think tanks like the Institute for the Study of War and all these places, neocon think tanks. It either has a D or an R on it, but that's where they go, and they just kind of wait in hiding until they can pop back up. And we know that the people who were involved in the Ukraine coup, U.S. coup in Ukraine, have all now jumped to top positions, like Victoria Nuland. She's now one of the most powerful people in the U.S. government. She's the one that, you know, credited with this ridiculous boneheaded idea, let's overthrow the Ukrainian government and bring some Nazis in power. That sounds like a good idea.
Well, the the other thing that we use to our detriment is the use of the assassination. We've done that for a long time over the years in this, the killing of Soleimani. And, you know, we've gone out of our way, at least try to be fair and balanced on what the news is, to give Trump, at least a fair coverage of what we think he's doing.
Yeah.
But that just doesn't make any sense at all that they did this. And sure, he was probably a strong man, and he probably had his dissenting people in Iran, but he certainly, well, that isn't the point as much as judging, is he a good guy or a bad guy, or what does he deserve? Who should be the policeman of the world and decide he is a bad guy and we are getting rid of him and think nobody will care? And some of those radicals that have developed have been developing since Soleimani has been assassinated.
Yeah.
So that can't be of any benefit. And I keep thinking there was assassination in the middle of the Vietnam War. Diem was assassinated with the participation of our CIA.
Yeah.
And that didn't help end the war. It prolonged the war. It gives them an incentive to fight. And once a long term, if there's a determination of a people, sometimes they win if they have strong determination against the people who have all the power and look like they have all the influence. It may take a while, but strong determination, you just think of the Afghans. People don't really ever defeat the Afghans.
Yeah.
They still exist. They're still in Afghanistan. It's been there for a few years, longer than the United States, for that matter. So this whole thing of assassinations, they ought to give that up. And of course, I would go to the next step. Unless there's a declared war, I would never think it is permissible morally or whether it's a wise policy to put on these terrible sanctions on the people.
Yeah.
This idea, we're gonna sanction so person here, this guy here, but it's the people that suffer the consequences. And just think how many sanctions have been put on Iran, and they think they're gonna work a peace treaty on this. And of course, that means they probably don't care about. And you mentioned already the dilemma they have because of Israel's position.
Yeah, and you know, Soleimani was the architect of the fight against ISIS. That literally was his role. So the assassination of some guy who was most responsible for getting rid of ISIS or fighting ISIS, it does make you again scratch your head. The most charitable interpretation I think you could make of that is that the U.S. didn't want to make sure that no one else got all the credit for taking out ISIS. Maybe that's the case, but. Do you want to move on to a couple of tidbits?
Yes, we can do that.
Let's put up the next one. I caught this over the weekend, Dr. Paul, and I wanted to bring it up and show you because I thought you'd find it interesting. You remember back at the time of the Super Bowl party, everyone was clicking their tongues. How dare these people out in the street celebrating the Super Bowl victory, celebrating Tampa Bay. And this is just an example of the articles that came out at that time. This is February 3rd. Officials fear Super Bowl could be next COVID-19 super spreader event. Remember, that was a scary word at that time, super spreader event. So let's go, let's look a few weeks later and see what happens. This is one chart that I found on Twitter. Let's look at the next clip really quick. Here's what actually happened. This is Hillsborough County, Florida. If you look at that line on February 7th, these are the maskless Super Bowl celebrations. The line are the daily new cases per million. No, it was not a super spreader event. In fact, the virus was gonna virus and it was already dying out. And in fact, let's look at the last one, Dr. Paul. This is Japan. This is about masks. And I think we're seeing some stuff breaking up. And in fact, I heard Abbott over the weekend saying he was thinking about rescinding some of his executive orders. Right. Yeah, how nice of him. Look at that last one, please. Here's Japan. This is really fascinating. Masks work. Here's May 8th, Vanity Fair saying, Japan is doing it right with masks. The New York Times on June 6th, masks worked in Japan. University of Maryland survey showed that there was a 95 to 98% mask compliance among the Japanese. Everyone was wearing a mask. And then look what happened a few weeks later. Cases in daily new deaths in Japan skyrocketed from COVID. How is it possible that the masks were so amazing and wonderful? Everyone was wearing them. How is it possible that this happened, Dr. Paul?
You haven't figured that out yet.
I don't know. I'm starting to be wondering about the masks. I might have to double up and triple up.
You just don't have any sympathy for the mask manufacturers.
That's right.
A little bit of crony capitalism there. No, I think the Super Bowl thing is interesting. I've always related to the use of sports to break the ice. You know, the congressional baseball team game that we used to play, the Republican against Democrat. It was the one time I thought we were very, very relaxed. And interesting enough, you know, even the Republicans who fought with the Democrats, and some of the fighting was real, they tended to do better when they played sports, sort of like kids, mm-hmm. you know, that you can play sports. Anyway, I'm sympathetic for that. But here, the Super Bowl in a good state where they got to play it. And I think there's a reason that things were better because, you know, the whole principle of disease is not sterile. You have it, you don't have it. There's so many other factors. You know, what your family situation is like, how much stress are you under, what kind of diet you're under, how much exercise you have. All of these things factor in. And I would say that the people who finally got really out and felt their oats and having a good time, that there was a reduction in the amount of the stress level. And believe it or not, that can help you feel better physically if you have reduced stress level. And maybe more people got more, maybe fresher air, you know, being out. And I'm sure people came from longer distances, that the parties were generally outside. And then this, it was a distraction too from some of the other things they didn't even want to think about. Maybe they didn't want to even think about, they didn't want to watch our program and think about Syria and a few other places. And that's a factor that I'd like to think was a positive factor. And the whole thing is the few people in that group that probably had used masks, well, they wouldn't dare do it because the consensus was that we're free again. And because of that, they're healthy again. And I know somebody will say, hey, that's a stretch. You're going too far. But still, it's a good theory.
Yeah, it is. Well, I'm done, Dr. Paul. I'll just say one thing, actually, one thing that's kind of depressing talking about this. My as you know, my son is distance learning because A&M is crazy right now. He went back to College Station on Friday because he had a meeting, and this is very, very sad. He was sitting in the engineering building, and he noticed there were other people without masks on, so he had his down. The university pays students to go around with clipboards and harass their fellow students if they don't have a mask on. So someone came over to my son, said, hey, put your mask on, really gruff. My son said, well, what about these other people who are not wearing it? And a couple minutes later, another kid came over with a clipboard and took down his information and said, you gave us attitude, we're gonna turn you in. These are fellow students snitching, being paid to snitch on fellow students for a disease that students don't get sick, these young people don't get sick from this. And what are the implications of turning these universities into little mini East Berlins? It was very depressing. I just want to bring it up. I hope all the Aggies out there are as upset about this, Aggie parents and former Aggies, as upset about it as I am and disgusted at what they've done.
You know, what you're telling is is not isolated. You know, neighbors sometimes will do it. And, you know, under the worst conditions of tyranny, the young people, especially, and kids are taught to be real heroes by turning in your relatives. And that's, we're moving in that direction. And that is a sad story. But we don't want to finish with that. So I'm going to talk about what I talk about all the time, because there's an answer to all this. We don't have to put up with this. We see bits and pieces. And Daniel did point out, you know, the successes that come from that. And there are a lot, and there's hardly a viral problem we have in this country now, but that's why they have to stir up trouble on our distraction. We have to start worrying about another bigger war in the Middle East. So they talk about that. But no, the answer to our problems, not a complete answer, just to make things better, keep it from getting worse, because tyranny causes people to spy on their neighbors and become a hero because you've turned in your neighbors. See, we have to get rid of that. We have to have more people understand the basic concept of liberty, that you own your life and you get to benefit by acting decently, and you promise not to hurt people. And guess what? If you get enough people doing that, society is pretty peaceful. And it's not complicated. You don't need politicians involved. Matter of fact, you want to get rid of the politicians. You don't want to have a system where the people who have the most money to lobby Washington to collect and get special deals, which is what we have, take the money from the middle class and give it to the military-industrial complex and stir up wars around the world, or spend billions and billions of dollars on some vaccines that nobody has proven they ever work. You're not going to know about the results of the vaccine probably for another year or two, and already there are stories about the vaccine. Liberty can answer a lot of questions, not all the questions, but it certainly would be better off than dependency, submission to the government and to the authoritarians. That's where we run into trouble. And guess what happens under those conditions? The people become miserable, unhappy, and angry, and turning on each other. That can be stopped just with the understanding and the initiation of a concept of liberty. The founders tried to do that, and we have drifted a long way off, but there's no reason why we can't start it again. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today to the Liberty Report. Please come back soon.